You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Jessica Toku Engoa, no mai haere mai ki te waia mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. I'm your host, Jessica, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producer Arno. Ewhai akine, coming up on the show, I speak to the New Zealand Drug Foundation's Principal Science Advisor, Emily Hughes, about synthetic opioids being sold as other substances. The Association of Salaried Medical Specialists Executive Director Sarah Dalton about how the incoming government's proposed tax cuts could impact investment in the health sector, and Senior Research Fellow at the University of Otago, Dr. Julie Bennett, about World Ventilate Day. Arno, what have you got for us today?
I speak to Assistant National Secretary Melissa Woolley from the Public Services Association about a care and support worker pay equity settlement that is being dragged out and delayed by Te Whatu Ora, and care and support worker Monique Behen-Kitto to get an on-the-ground perspective from a care and support worker. And I speak to bioengineer Dr. Kelly Burrows from the University of Auckland about new research around how vaping affects the lungs.
He aha o whakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces. So get in touch, tuku patuhi mai. Text in on 5395 or give us a call in the studio on 09309 3879. Ka oe e wariwari e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kōrero. Anohi paki heri roki roki mā runga I te pai tuku tuku o irirangi poho. Mi haere ki 95BFM irakati.com, and you can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Drug checking providers have reported seeing an increase in a group of synthetic opioids, nitazenes, being sold as other substances, with High Alert warning this week about a highly potent synthetic opioid being misrepresented as butonitazene. I spoke to NZ Drug Foundation Principal Science Advisor Emily Hughes about this recent development. I started off our interview asking Hughes why they are concerned about the growing prevalence of nitazenes in the community, especially if they are being sold as something else.
The increase in availability of these substances in general is obviously a concern because they are so potent and they can be really difficult to dose and to use safely. And earlier this year, you would have seen that metronidazine, another one of these drugs, was misrepresented as sold as oxycodone originally, which is, again, obviously a concern because of their differences in dosage. In this case, it was presumed to be a nitazine, but the nitazine, butonitazine that it was presumed to be, is a bit weaker and also lasts a lot, it lasts way shorter than the substances that it actually was, which means that obviously people are expecting for it to wear off in a shorter period of time and then are experiencing those effects for much, much longer, which can be quite dangerous.
What do we know about how much these synthetic opioids are in the community in Aotearoa?
That's a great question, because obviously we only know from what we see either presenting to hospitals, people who've died, or those substances that are coming to drug checking. But that's probably only a small sliver of the people who are possibly accessing these substances. We do know that these were available on the dark web, so it's possible that they're all across the country. Right now, the issue is, relatively contained, and most people who are using these substances are people who already use opioids. But of course, we're concerned that this issue will continue to grow in New Zealand.
What can nitazenes look like when being sold as something else, in particular the butonitazene that was found this week?
In the case of the butanitazine, it was a yellow powder, but we've actually seen nitazines in multiple different forms. So we've seen them in pills, we've seen them in powders, we've seen them in liquids, and they can come in all different colors and all different shapes and sizes, which means that there's not kind of one specific thing to look out for when you're looking out for these substances, which is all the more reason why people should get their substances checked at their drug checking clinic if they're able to.
What dangers can nitazines pose, particularly, like you said, if they are taken unknowingly in a higher dose than expected?
Absolutely. And I think because these substances are so strong, you know, most of them are as potent as fentanyl or much more potent. The reality is that when people take them, they can overdose very quickly. So there's often not a lot of time between them taking the substance and then them experiencing symptoms of an overdose. So the main danger with these drugs is that somebody stops breathing. They cause something called respiratory depression, which basically means that the functions of these opioids slow down your body so much that you completely stop breathing and in some cases, you know, lose your pulse and pass away. And so because they're so, so strong and active in such low doses, this is far more likely than it would be with a lower grade opioid, say codeine, for instance.
You've mentioned that synthetic opioids that were first detected in the country about a year ago have been linked to several deaths. Can you tell us a little bit more about this?
So what we know is what was in the high alert notification that went out the other day that suggested that these nitazines were possibly linked to several deaths in New Zealand. Unfortunately, the kind of coronial process in the case takes some time for those to go through, so it will be a wee while before we kind of know more information on exactly how many people have passed away and how many hospitalizations have been implicated with these substances. But of course, we do know that we're seeing an increase in harm in relation to these substances, as is most of the rest of the world as well.
For those people who may be around others that are taking drugs, what are the signs of an opioid overdose that people should look out for?
Thank you for asking that question, because that's really kind of the point that we really want to drill home. So there's a couple of things that we tell people to really keep an eye out for. These are obviously if the person becomes unresponsive. So if they look like they're sleeping and they're not responding to you yelling, hey, wake up, or to even administering kind of physical touch like a sternum rub or a collarbone knock. If they look really pale or clammy, or if they have blue lips or blue fingertips, sometimes they might make kind of a snoring or a gurgling noise as well, which is a sign that they're overdosing. And of course, looking at their breathing and their pulse. So if their breathing is slowed or stopped, or if they have a weak or no pulse, that's the sign that that they're in an overdose and that you really do need to act quickly.
And what are some other steps people can take if they are taking drugs to prevent harm?
I think just in terms of harm reduction, you know, if people do choose to take these substances, a couple really key things that's super important. And of course, people can also go to thelevel.org.nz to get more information and follow High Alert. But a couple of things that are really important that we just want to share with people is if you can access naloxone, please have it on hand. Make sure you have a sober buddy with you who can get help, because you won't be able to give naloxone to yourself and you also won't be able to call 111 for yourself. And that's really important. Start very low with really low doses. And if you do have a pill or a bag of powder, give it a really good mix and make sure it's all amalgamated so that you don't get an inconsistent dose between one bit and another, and that you just take a really, really small amount before you start, and avoid mixing with any other drugs, medicines, or alcohol, because that can also really increase your risk of overdose. So if people do choose to take these substances, we really want them to have as many safeguards put in place so that you know, that they're safe and that they don't end up in hospital. And so those tips are also available on the Level and on High Alert's website as well.
The New Zealand Drug Foundation has been an advocate for increasing the availability of naloxone, an opioid overdose reversal medicine. Can you tell us about why this is important?
So naloxone is an opioid overdose reversal medicine, like you said, and it can come in the form of ampules, which are injected, or in the form of nasal spray. And the amazing thing about naloxone is that when you administer it, it can increase the respiration rate of people, meaning that they can buy themselves some time before medical help arrives. And this is extra important with these nitazines because of how quickly they cause overdose. Sometimes, you know, somebody might be in a full-blown overdose well before an ambulance can get to them or well before they can get to a hospital. So being able to administer one or two or three doses of naloxone can honestly save someone's life. And with these substances, it's so important that we have access to this life-saving drug.
Drug checking services can help prevent the risks involved in taking drugs. What can people expect from a drug checking service?
Yeah, that's a great question. And many listeners may know that drug checking services in New Zealand are completely free, legal, and confidential. So you won't get in trouble for going there. It's not going to, you know, it's not going to result in any legal action taken against you. It's a very safe environment. So people come in, they bring us a small amount of their substance, so just kind of the size of a matchstick head. However, if they do have a substance they're suspicious about, obviously, always great if we can test the whole pill or the whole bag just to be double sure. We'll put their substance on our spectrometer and we'll use some reagents and fentanyl test strips and benzo test strips. And then we'll let them know the results of those tests and what's in their substance. And you might have seen in this notification that this particular substance was also sent to our national laboratory called ESR. And they did some further testing on it to kind of exactly identify what it is that our machines aren't always able to do. And then clients can also get the results of that testing online. It's a really great way for people to also have a harm reduction conversation. So if they do decide they want to take that substance, we can talk them through all of the harm reduction measures they can take to be safer, which is really the most important part of the service.
Where can people go to find out about where drug checking services are happening?
Yeah, if they jump onto thelevel.org.nz, there's a little drug checking tab there, which leads them straight to our calendar where they're able to find out where clinics are in various regions. And we also welcome them to contact us on the Level Contact Us page if they have any questions or if there's not drug checking clinics in their area, but they're, you know, they want to know how they might be able to access them in the future, then certainly encourage them to do that. And we also have a great FAQ page on there where people can kind of see what the service looks like, which can be helpful if you're nervous, especially if it's your first time using one of these clinics.
And what are some other steps people can take if they are taking drugs to prevent harm?
I think just in terms of harm reduction, you know, if people do choose to take these substances, a couple really key things that's super important. And of course, people can also go to thelevel.org.nz to get more information and follow High Alert. But a couple of things that are really important that we just want to share with people is if you can access naloxone, please have it on hand. Make sure you have a sober buddy with you who can get help because you won't be able to give naloxone to yourself and you also won't be able to call 111 for yourself. And that's really important. Start very low with really low doses. And if you do have a pill or a bag of powder, give it a really good mix and make sure it's all amalgamated so that you don't get an inconsistent dose between one bit and another and that you just take a really, really small amount before you start and avoid mixing with any other drugs, medicines, or alcohol, because that can also really increase your risk of overdose. So if people do choose to take these substances, we really want them to have as many safeguards put in place so that you know that they're safe and that they don't end up in hospital. And so those tips are also available on the Level and on High Alert's website as well.
That was NZ Drug Foundation Principal Science Advisor Emily Hughes speaking about a concerning increase of misrepresented synthetic opioids in the community.
The Wire.
And we'll be right back after this short song break. Keep it on the B.
Whether black or white, Just remember that. We all got a right to live. This I truly believe. We all got to die one day. No one is here on earth to stay. Listen, people. You want to live? This I believe. Black or white, you're still going to die.
It's high time J-Day rolled around. So thank goodness a new date has been set. The annual Cannabis Law Reform Rally and Concert will take place on Saturday, December 2nd in Albert Park.
Bring your buddies to learn something new or kick back and enjoy the market stalls, food trucks, guest speakers and excellent music.
J-Day. A free R18 event presented by Normal with thanks to the Hemp Store. Saturday, December 2nd in Albert Park, high noon till 4:20.
The Hemp Store on K Road is what you need.
Your favourite team, sports team, teamed up with your favourite band, The Betts, and made a movie, The Betts Concert Film, screening at the Hollywood Avondale, Tuesday, November 14.
Hey, it's sports team.
Hi.
In 2020, we made a movie about The Betts nationwide tour, and this will be the first ever public screening.
Plus, there'll be a Q&A with us and The Betts, hosted by Jesse Mulligan.
All proceeds will go towards our very first feature film.
The Betts Concert Film, The Hollywood Avondale, Tuesday, November 14, tickets via Under the Radar.
The War on Drugs are coming to Aotearoa in support of their recent album, I Don't Live Here Anymore.
And we're giving away tickets, so get your B-card and stay tuned to BFM Breakfast for your cue to enter.
The War on Drugs with special guests Spoon and Indigo Spark at Spark Arena, December 2nd. Get your tickets now from livenation.co.nz.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Care and support workers are currently in the midst of a pay equity agreement, with all three major unions undertaking work to make sure workers are paid equitably. The workers, predominantly women, last received a pay rise in 2017, and their wages have simply not matched the cost of living. In some cases, workers, who often use their own cars to drive to clients, have to stay beyond their paid hours just to make sure the people they are caring for receive the appropriate care. Te Whatu Ora has delayed the pay equity settlement despite not being directly involved in the relationship between employees and employers. This has got some union members and representatives riled up. Following International Care and Support Day, I spoke to the Public Service Association Assistant Secretary, Melissa Woolley. I started our interview by asking what the PSA is and what it does.
Public Service Association is a union for community and public service workers across Aotearoa. We've got 90,000 members and we represent workers all across, from community organisations, the Te Whatu Ora employed staff, public servants who are directly employed across the public service and local government organisations.
What is the International Day for Care and Support about?
Yeah, so unions celebrated on the 29th of October the first ever International Day for Care and Support Workers. And we're really proud to have the care and support worker profession being acknowledged as a bit of a profession by its first International Day. The day is about valuing and recognising people who deliver essential healthcare services across our communities to our elderly, our injured, our disabled, who live at home or live in residential facilities across our mutu. I also think that care workers across the world on this day were calling on their various governments to improve the working conditions for care and support workers across the world, as care and support workers predominantly delivered by women. And because it's predominantly provided by women, it continues to be undervalued and underpaid.
Can you give a brief history on the pay equity claim that was filed last year?
Yeah. So in July last year, PSA, E2 and NZNO raised a pay equity claim across 15 employers across the care and support sector, which is roughly about a third of the care and support workforce, which is 65,000 care and support workers. And we did that because that was the first possible day we could do so, because there was previous legislation that enacted a step towards pay equity in 2017. So we raised that claim and have been working at pace with the employers to go through the pay equity process by doing interviews with care and support workers across the country to talk about the skills, the degree of effort and knowledge that care and support workers hold by being a care and support worker. We've gone through that process and we are at the final stages of being able to enter into formal negotiations with the employers to reach a pay equity settlement. Unfortunately, that was halted because Te Whatawarā, who is the key funder of care and support services across Aotearoa, decided it wanted to do a review of the process and the work that the unions and the employers have done to date for care and support workers. We absolutely think that this is outrageous. It is outrageous that Te Whatawarā, as a funder, are interfering in the pay equity process. Care and support workers could be having a pay equity settlement by now had Te Whatawarā not interfered in this process. The unions will not participate in the review. We have no interest in the review and we stand by the work that we have done throughout the process in a vigorous process to highlight the undervaluation of the work that care and support workers do. So we're calling on the government, the incoming government, to prioritise pay equity and prioritise pay equity for this group of workers, to stop Te Whatawarā interfering in the process. Let us get on and get into bargaining and get a deal for care and support workers. They are the lowest paid group of health workers across our country, largely on the minimum wage, largely women. Often people are driving their cars in between clients and getting a small subsidy from the government to use their own cars to travel and are paid the minimum wage. And it's time that care and support workers were valued and paid what they are owed.
Now, on that note, with the new government coming into power, how likely does it seem that the pay equity claim will be approved?
We're giving it our best shot. We're expecting this government to deliver on pay equity and pay equity for the lowest paid group of workers. The original 2017 settlement was delivered under a national government and we're hoping and expecting that they will continue in the same vein that they did in 2017, which is a step towards pay equity for the care and support workforce. We're also wanting that to be done through legislation and deliver the pay equity settlement through legislation, and we're expecting this government to prioritise this group of workers, low-paid workers, as one of the first things that they do coming into power.
Early in October, an open letter was launched urging healthcare funders to stop unjust delays for pay equity. Can you tell us a bit more about this letter?
Yeah, so we did launch an open letter, PSA, NZNO and E2, around the interference that Te Whatawarā are doing around the review process. Te Whatawarā are going ahead with this review despite a strong opposition from the three unions. We are still calling on people to sign this open letter. We are wanting to present that to the chief executives of the four key funding agencies who we believe are interfering in the pay equity process, and we're wanting to do that relatively soon. We've only got 6,000 signatures at the moment, so we're encouraging everyone to sign this open letter and support care and support workers for their aim of getting pay equity and getting pay equity soon. They need it now. This is urgent. Care and support workers are really struggling with the increased cost of living and the increased petrol prices that they're facing. So this is urgent.
What rationale are healthcare agencies using to delay the pay equity settlement?
They're wanting to look at a couple of factors of the pay equity process. So So they are wanting to explore the fact that we have come up with one care and support worker role for the 17,500 workers, and hopefully extend it out to the whole 65,000. So they're concerned that there's one care and support worker role, but we know with other roles that such as nurses and such as teachers, a teacher is a teacher, a nurse is a nurse, and why should care and support workers see multiple roles? I think also the evidence has provided us that there is one care and support worker role as well, and they don't agree with that. The second is they've got some concerns about the comparators that we have used throughout the process, and requested that we added additional comparators. We did add additional comparators. It didn't change the outcome, and now they're wanting to independently review the choice that the unions and employers made about the comparators that we used. It's completely inappropriate. The parties to the claim are the unions and the employers. It is not the funder's role to interfere in the work, the pay equity work, that the unions and employers have done.
Next, I spoke to a care and support worker named Monique Behan-Kitto. They have unique insight into the struggles faced by workers and the struggle for pay equity. I started our interview by asking about Monique's role as a care and support worker.
I'm a home and community support worker, so I go into people's homes and support them, and I've been doing it for roughly 15 years.
What does an average day in your role look like?
It can be anything from getting people out of bed, showering them, helping with medications, doing housework, taking people shopping, or we go into the higher needs stuff where it's hospital, nearly hospital level care with dementia and stroke rehab, and yeah, no 2 days are the same, and our role is very varied.
Now, you mentioned you'd been working in the sector for 15 years. Have you noticed any changes in working conditions and workload while working as a healthcare worker?
Yes. Big time. I first started under a non-profit organisation, a local EB organisation. We were given whatever time we needed. If we needed an increase in time because we saw someone was deteriorating, we just rang the office and says, look, we need an increase because of these things. They would then get a hold of the funders and have that put in place. We're now on the third company. It's a for-profit company, and our role has increased, yet our times continually get decreased. It's kind of hard to explain that the funding pressures that are on the sector as it is, from the person that we support's point of view, and then it impacts on us and our guaranteed hours. And we do a lot of our work for free in the end, because we run over time, but we can't leave someone in the middle of, say, a shower because we've run out of time. We will continue on and finish that work and end up doing the voluntary work that we have been doing for many years.
Now, do you know how the organisation that you belong to is funded?
Yes, multiple contracts. I usually follow the DHB over 65 contract, but then we also have ACC and mixed funding contracts as well.
How have you been coping with the increased cost of living? Has your pay been raised to match?
So in 2017, we were given the care and support settlement. We were given an increase of 49% on our wages, and it was amazing. Over the last 5 years that has played out, our cost of living has increased so exponentially that we are now just sitting above minimum wage yet again. And I run my car at a loss every fortnight. I do not get paid the correct amount to run my car. I get enough for gas, but not the insurances, the warrants, the rego, the wear and tear. Yeah, because we're constantly travelling. I do roughly 450 kilometres a week in my car.
How have your colleagues been faring with the increased cost of living?
The same. We have lost a lot of workers to go back into residential care or working in rest homes, just because the cost of petrol itself is too expensive to continue doing our job, which is very, very sad because we love our work in the community.
Now, are you a member of a union, and do you support the pay equity claim that was filed last year?
Yes, I am a member of ETU. I'm a union delegate, and I also sit on the Community Support Services Industry Council. And yes, I do fully support the pay equity process. It's just frustrating when things are held up.
That was Melissa Woolley, Assistant National Secretary of the Public Service Association Union, speaking about the struggles experienced while trying to obtain pay equity for care and support workers, as well as Monique Behen-Kitto, a worker who has been struggling in their role.
Well, what a phenomenal thing for you to say.
The Wire.
This week, a patient reportedly waited 4.5 months for an urgent MRI scan at Dunedin Hospital. I spoke to Association of Salaried Medical Specialists Executive Director Sarah Dalton about this incident and what they believe it indicates about the current state of our health system. We also discussed the incoming government's proposed tax cuts and how this might affect investment in healthcare. Here is that interview. What do you think this particular incident indicates about the current state of our health system?
Yeah, it's a really, really horrible example, isn't it? Because it's you know, the result of that delay is that person's medical condition is now terminal, you know, and debate arguably a timely scan and proper diagnosis might have avoided that. Obviously, it's a serious medical issue for them. But that's just one example of many, many. You know, there are hundreds of thousands of New Zealanders who don't even get a diagnosis because they can't access a GP, either through location or cost or a combination of those things. And then for those people who do see GPs and get specialist referrals, there are many thousands who have significant delays to accessing appointments, diagnostic procedures, and then treatment. And that's because we don't fund our health system properly.
So you mentioned underfunding. What has led our health system to reach somewhat of a breaking point?
Well, if you look at international comparisons, and I'm just pulling this from OECD social spending data, we have some of the lowest public social expenditure per head in the OECD. And they're probably comparable countries, you know, the European countries, Australia, Canada, the US. So we just don't invest that much on each other, you know, on health and social spending. So, and we live in cold, damp houses, and we don't have a very mature attitude to people who live in rental accommodation as opposed to those people who own their own homes. So all of those things are contributors to health and wellbeing.
The incoming government has promised tax cuts. How do you think this might affect our investment in health?
Yeah, I'm genuinely concerned about that, and obviously somewhere in the vicinity of 37-38% of New Zealanders, you know, agreed with what the National Party was advocating in terms of tax cuts, and then another, 10% or so who voted for ACT. But given that the health system's already underfunded, that there are significant staffing shortages and building and infrastructure problems, a lower tax take must signal bad news for health. You know, it is very expensive to fund health, but, you know, there is evidence also to show the fiscal multiplier, you know, which is basically every dollar you spend, what do you get back? Every dollar we spend on health actually generates $4.3 back. So this isn't just about being good and kind to each other in terms of, you know, a well-being budget or a well-being approach. It actually makes economic sense to fund health properly because a healthy population is a much more productive population.
And in particular with the professionals that you represent, what are the most pressing issues that you see needing investment?
Of completely workforce, so we're the union for senior doctors and dentists. Te Whatu Ora have estimated that there's a shortage of 1,700 senior doctors, and they include GPs in that number. We would argue that there is a shortfall of at least 1,700 hospital-based specialists, and there is a further gap, I'm not quite sure of the number, but of specialist GPs around the country. So the number is definitely more than 1,700, but even if we accept that number, there has been no traction, no evidence of improvements in recruitment or retention since Te Whatu Ora was created, you know, a year and a half ago. And our own members are telling us through surveys and when we're talking to them that more of them are contemplating or actually reducing their commitment to working in the public health system. So a number are increasing their hours in private, some are leaving public altogether, and of course some are leaving New Zealand altogether.
And the government, the National and the ACT Party have expressed concerns about our workforce or people in general moving overseas for better pay and opportunities. What are some ways that you can see this being avoided?
Well, you know, we are just at the end of a very long series of pay negotiations for our MECA, our collective agreement, which is where the bulk of our members work. And it's been horrible. You know, it's seen senior doctors and dentists take national strike action for the first time in our history. There seems to be this big disconnect between known staffing shortages and the one thing the employer could do to promote New Zealand as a better destination or to encourage people who are already here to stay, which is improve their salaries. You know, compared to the average New Zealander, doctors earn a reasonable amount of money, but internationally it doesn't stack up, and our nearest neighbour, Australia, pays substantially more to senior doctors who choose to work there. We have members who send us job offers. They could double their income simply by moving to Australia. So it's tough. But we don't expect that doctors' salaries will be doubled here in New Zealand, but it has been a real struggle to try and conclude negotiations this time round. And there's just this complete disconnect between the reality of what's going on. They're like, oh, it's really hard to staff our services. And when we give them an opportunity to improve terms and conditions, they walk away from that.
What would your calls be to the incoming government when it comes to investing in the health sector and addressing those issues like pay, working conditions and staff shortages?
Well, I guess what I would say is look to your own data. So in 2020, Treasury estimated that the economic cost of people living with ill health was somewhere between $10 and $27 billion a year. Currently, we spend about $21 billion on health per year, or in that same year. So it's actually cost, you know, it would cost us less as a country to invest more in health than it actually does not to invest. So, you know, take the plunge, bear the upfront costs, and then reap the economic and social benefits in the medium to longer term. I mean, so I would encourage them to look hard at the evidence, including the financial evidence that Treasury provides, and see that improved investment in our healthcare system and the people who work in it, primarily the clinical staff, but others as well, makes financial sense, and that is what a fiscally responsible government would do.
And that was Association of Salaried Medical Specialists Executive Director Sarah Dalton on the importance of investing in healthcare.
You are listening to The Wire.
Well, first of all,
The Wire.
And we'll be right back. Keep it on the beat. We've just got a quick song for you.
As the bright clubs flush out, the bright young things onto the quieting bunch on the night bus. Quite what I love about the night bus is beside me sometimes when that guy comes up.
You've been the future's not what it used to be. These are the good old days, just you wait and see.
As painted nails tap rhythms on protected screens, J jaded eyes glancing at techno streams, the trainee nurses and the keen on makeup, a baby wails mainly for space and a meal, graying hair recedes and the pace of life speeds, could be 8 or 3 on the 83.
You think the future's not what it used to be? These are the good old days, just you wait and see.
Stale breath battles what vapes make sweet. Snazzle of a headphone on a gamer in grief. Anger-ridden teens too scared to make a scene. Conveyor belt preening of layered hair that plainly needs seeing to. White dust drugs and sights too shock. Nice loving mums on the night bus. Oh, the night bus club with the high street under.
You the sky that's done
fighting this rock.
These are the good old days, just you wait and see.
Surprised by a look from some eyes that are up before their iPhone summons them, and I'm left looking at eyes that shrug, then that type of look where eyes touch once. She sizes me up and then denies the moment with the eyes looking up. A tight blush comes and I fight with love. I've got a right flush up, but I try to shrug, because the night bus home is like a night bus club. I guide my shookness out to the night that's stuck between night and sun. The lighthouse is guiding our eyes to signs like chameleon, lies and change. Outside an eternal glinting picture of serpentine glimmering rivers of piss. As the bright clubs flush out the bright young things onto the quieting bunch on the night bus.
What's a 7-letter word for street fighter? Brawler. You're right. Hey, what's happening at Ponsonby Social Club this week?
Well, tonight there's
Batiko Beats with Julian Cyan, Amanda Bovo and guests with support from DJ Bobby Bazooka. And tomorrow, Comedy Night with Corey Gonzalez-McCure and friends, followed by DJs Anna Beatrice and Boyd Main.
Same old Ponsonby Social Club, 152 Ponsonby Road.
Experience George Romero's cult classic Night of the Living Dead like never before, live in this exhilarating and totally thrilling collision of theatre, cinema and music. Watch the film as two performers attempt to create every sound effect, play an epic new score and voice every character in the film bar one. Live cinema. Night of the Living Dead, created by Leon Radojkovic, presented by Silo Theatre. On now at the Hollywood in Avondale. Book now at iTicket.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
Nest Fest is back for 2024 with 5 stages and over 70 artists performing across 2 days. This is one summer festy you don't want to miss. And we have a few tickets. So if you're nice to us and you have a B-card, maybe we can chuck a few your way? Just listen to BFM Breakfast all week for your chance to enter. 95 BFM presents Nest Fest, January 5th or 6th at Tor Moana Showgrounds in the magical Hawke's Bay. Get your tickets now from nestfest.co.nz.
For old time's sake, yes or no, would you like to be leader of the National Party at some point?
No, I'm just focused on what I'm doing. I'm one of those people that do it day by day, job by job.
I'll save this clip and come back to it in 5 or 10 years. We'll see how it's aged.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire on 95 BFM. Vaping is still shrouded in a cloud of mystery, and the effects it has on our health is largely unknown. With record numbers of Kiwis turning to vapes, a lot of interest has been placed in finding out how bad they really are. Last time I spoke with Dr. Kelly Burrows, bioengineering PhD at the University of Auckland, they were calling for tighter regulations on vaping. Many of these regulations are now imminent. Dr. Burrows recently obtained two research grants that will together span a total of 5 years, looking into the effects of vaping on the lungs. I started our interview by asking about these grants.
So I'm very privileged to have got two different funding amounts for my research. So one is the James Cook Fellowship, which is a two-year research funding, and one is a three-year Royal Society of New Zealand Marsden grant. So in both of these projects, we're sort of aiming to look for early changes and how vaping affects the lungs. So if you think about smoking, it took at least 50 years for us to really understand the long-term health effects. So what we're trying to do in our research is really get some early ideas for those changes so that we can really get more educated and more evidence in terms of the health effects of vaping. So in the fellowship, we'll be looking at things like measurements from exhaled breath. We're going to take some more images of people's lungs and measure the blood vessels. And in the other Marsden project, we're looking at what's called the lymphatic vessels. So these have been found to be damaged from smoking and COVID-19. And we want to see if the same thing happens with vaping.
What do we already know about the way vaping affects our bodies?
So one of the things that is looking to be pretty well known is that when you vape, and the same for when you breathe in anything that isn't clean air, it triggers the immune system. So it can cause what's called inflammation, which is basically your body's normal response to getting rid of something foreign from your body. And it's when you get this inflammation repeating sort of, you know, many times every day, which is when things can go wrong. We also know that nicotine can have effects on our heart rate, on our blood flow in our bodies, and that, again, over the long term, that can cause changes in how our blood vessels work.
Are there any major unanswered questions when it comes to vaping and the effect it has on our bodies?
Yes, absolutely. So as I mentioned at the start, so it's really the long-term health effects. So no one knows those yet. So as I said, with smoking, it took at least 50 years to really see a link between things like lung cancer and emphysema. Vaping has really only been around for 20 years and for a much shorter amount of time in New Zealand. It's only been really popular here for about 5 years. So you can imagine it's going to take maybe another 20, 30 years for us to really understand the long-term effects. So that's really the big unknown. But also there is a big range of scientific data coming out. And I think the fact that there's so many different vaping products, so many different e-liquids, ways of using vapes, that actually, you know, there's no consensus really on what the health effects are yet.
Vaping is popular among young people, many of whom have never smoked. Is there any research or hypotheses on how it affects brain development?
I do know that when people start using nicotine products at an earlier age, so when your brain is still developing, if you're a teenager, adolescent, your brain is still developing. So when you start using nicotine then, it actually kind of makes your brain need that nicotine more. So it can lead to, you know, higher chance of addiction and much higher difficulty to give up that nicotine. But I have also read that, you know, when younger people who are addicted to nicotine, it can cause sort of difficulty with concentrating and impulse control and those sorts of things. So it's really not ideal.
Is the trouble with vaping the nicotine or other associated chemicals in the vapor cloud?
So again, no one really knows that. And as I said, I think part of it may just be the fact that you're breathing something in that isn't air, so it could be any one of the chemicals. But there are, you know, as I said, known effects from nicotine, such as on the brain and on the blood vessels. But in terms of the other harmful effects in the lungs, no one really knows. So there's a range of different chemicals in e-liquids, so the flavorings, propylene glycol, vegetable glycerol, nicotine, but plus there can also be things like some metals coming off the different parts of the devices. So no one really knows which chemical or if it's going to be one or all of them together that causes harm.
For those that enjoy using a vape, of which I am included, is there any harm reduction advice that you could give?
Harm reduction from vaping? Well, I would say if you could do it less often. That's probably one thing. Again, I don't really know. I mean, maybe if it's something you could eventually try and give up by reducing the amount of nicotine. Yeah, one thing I've seen that they've looked at overseas and in terms of surveying younger people, they looked at whether if all of the flavourings were removed. So let's say you could only get tobacco-flavoured e-liquid. There was a study in the US that showed 70% of kids would actually stop vaping if they couldn't get those yummy flavours. I don't know if that applies to you, but yeah, that could be one thing to help reduce people from the frequency of vaping at least.
In line with that, do you think the new regulations coming into effect later this month, I believe, are a sufficient safeguard against potential harms from vaping, or does the government need to go further?
Yeah, I think the government needs to go further. I think it's still way too easy for young people to access vaping products. So things like, you know, you can still buy disposable vapes, and you can get them as cheaply as $2 for a vape. So, you know, it's way too accessible, affordable for kids to be able to get them. So, I think we should definitely do more to get rid of those disposable vapes. We should reduce the number of flavourings that can be obtained and maybe reduce the number of vape shops. You know, there's about 1,200 vape shops in New Zealand at the moment, which is more than the number of community pharmacies and of the number of KFCs and McDonald's combined.
That was Dr. Kelly Burrows from the University of Auckland on the start of new studies into the effects of vaping.
Classic journo question as well. Can I have a jaw?
The Wire.
Today is World Ventilate Day, which aims to highlight the importance of good ventilation for our health and well-being. I spoke to Senior Research Fellow at the University of Otago, Dr. Julie Bennett, who says New Zealand is lagging behind when it comes to indoor ventilation standards. I started off by asking Bennett about the purpose of World Ventilation Day. Here is that interview.
World Ventilation Day is really just getting people aware of what ventilation is, which is bringing fresh outdoor air in, fresh clean outdoor air inside, and replacing old stale air from the inside.
How can the quality of the air that we breathe indoors affect our health and well-being?
So if you're breathing in pollutants, which can be in the air, they can accumulate from indoor sources, or they can come from outdoor sources as well. They can cause respiratory issues, cardiovascular problems, allergic symptoms, asthma, cancers. And actually in New Zealand, around 3,300 people die prematurely from breathing poor quality air. Can also, if you've got no ventilation and air can't circulate, you can also cause respiratory illnesses as well.
How do we here in New Zealand compare to other countries when it comes to our indoor ventilation standards?
We don't know a lot about our New Zealand buildings because very little monitoring is done in our buildings. But what we do know is from our groups, the monitoring we have done, many buildings don't meet our current building code ventilation standards, and these standards are actually less than what other countries have at the moment.
How would you recommend that we improve our air quality standards here in New Zealand?
Well, we don't actually have any indoor air quality standards, so I think we need a national organisation to address indoor air quality that has a focus on health and well-being. So I think we need to introduce indoor air quality guidelines as a first step, and eventually update our building code to ensure that we've got good ventilation in our building. One other thing that we could do here in New Zealand is public spaces could have carbon dioxide monitors. So carbon dioxide monitors are a proxy for ventilation. And when the level gets too high, it means there's lots of people breathing in a space. And other countries have introduced these in places like bars and pubs and restaurants and public spaces to show people how good the ventilation is. And if you know it's got good ventilation, then you know you've got a reduced risk of catching a respiratory infection.
What would updating our building code look like?
Well, I guess the pandemic has really highlighted the importance of ventilation to reduce infectious diseases. And so other countries have started to incorporate requirements for things like mechanical ventilation in homes. So where it's not relying on the occupant to open windows to have the ventilation, and the air can be also filtered to ensure that it is clean air that we are breathing.
How can individuals in the meantime go about improving the air quality in their homes?
Well, I think a really easy thing to do is every day is to open all of your windows for 10 minutes in the morning and 10 minutes in the evening, and that just means that the air in your home is circulating and is fresh. And it's good to do that kind of burst ventilation with 10 minutes in the morning and 10 minutes in later in the day. I guess one other thing that we could do here in New Zealand is public spaces could have carbon dioxide monitors. So carbon dioxide monitors are a proxy for ventilation. And when the level gets too high, it means there's lots of people breathing in a space. And other countries have introduced these in places like bars and pubs and restaurants and public spaces to show people how good the ventilation is. And if you know it's got good ventilation, then you know you've got a reduced risk of catching a respiratory infection.
That was University of Otago's Dr. Julie Bennett on their calls to improve ventilation in Aotearoa.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, ne te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki o mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Wednesday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today. Melissa Woolley from the PSA, care and support worker Monique Behan-Kitto, Dr. Kelly Burrows from the University of Auckland, New Zealand Drug Foundation Principal Science Advisor Emily Hughes, Association of Salaried Medical Specialists Executive Director Sarah Dalton, and Senior Research Fellow at the University of Otago, Dr. Julie Bennett. Me ra hoki te mihi ki a koutou I whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1-4.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.